What's happening, people? Welcome back to the show. My guest today is James Smith. He's a PT and not a life coach. We are talking about finding success in dating, finances, and happiness. It's a weird time to be alive. The rules are completely out of the window for dating. Finding a balance between socializing and work is basically impossible. There are a million different ways to organize your personal finances, and that's before you even start to throw Tinder into the mix. Thankfully, me and James have obviously led flawless lives where we've never made any mistakes and have this perfectly laid out life plan. So today we're going to put the world to rights and give you our best advice. Expect to learn why James is actually glad to be back from Australia, the optimal approach for getting a kangaroo to tap out in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, what's interesting about being a guy in your 30s without kids, why James doesn't want to invest his money into property, and much more. If you are new here, or if you're a long-time listener, make sure that you have hit the subscribe button. It is the only way that you can ensure that you will never miss an episode. And it makes me very happy, and it supports the podcast. So just open your little app and press the plus button in the corner, or press follow or subscribe in the middle of the page. A thank you. All right, quick maths. The less that your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have, the more money that you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce the costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you are improving efficiency by bringing all your business processes into one platform. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the maths and see how you will profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/modern right now. That's netsuite.com/modern. This episode is brought to you by Whoop. I've worn Whoop for over 4 years now, since way before they were a partner on the show, and it is the only wearable I have ever stuck with because it's the best. It is so innocuous, you do not remember that you've got it on, and yet it tracks absolutely everything 24/7 via something from your wrist. It tracks your heart rate, it tracks your sleep, your recovery, all of your workouts, your resting heart rate, your heart rate variability, how much you're breathing throughout the night. It puts all of this into an app and spits out very simple, easy to understand, and fantastically usable data. It's phenomenal. I am a massive, massive fan of Whoop, and that is why it's the only wearable that I've ever stuck with. You can join for free, pay nothing for the brand new Whoop 4.0 strap, plus you get your first month for free, and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee, so you can buy it for free, try it for free, and if you do not like it, after 29 days, they will give you your money back. Head to join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. That's join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. This episode is brought to you by AG1. AG1 is a daily foundational nutrition supplement that supports whole body health. Even with the best diet in the world, it is hard to make sure that you get everything that you need. And through a science-driven formulation of vitamins, probiotics, and whole food-sourced nutrients, AG1 delivers comprehensive support for the brain, gut, and immune system. This is why Joe Rogan and Lex Fridman and Dr. Andrew Huberman and Tim Ferriss are all massive fans. They have tried every other product out there, like I have, and this is by far the best one available. Since 2010, AG1 have improved the formula 52 times in the pursuit of making the best foundational nutrition supplement possible through high quality ingredients and rigorous standards. Also, there's a 90-day money-back guarantee, so you can buy it and try it for 89 days, and if you don't like it, they'll just give you your money back. Head to drinkag1.com/modernwisdom for that 90-day money-back guarantee, a year's free supply, vitamin D, 5 free travel packs, and more. That's drinkag1.com/modernwisdom. But now, it's time for the wise and wonderful James Smith. James Smith, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Difficult second album today.
Why'd you say that?
Well, you have a good debut, and then the second one, you've got to keep up with the talent, you know?
If you're thinking about films as well, often the second one is never as good as the first. But I've got faith, because we were saying just off air now, I've got a proper setup. I'm sat at a desk. I feel professional. I've got a professional microphone. I'm ready.
Yeah, so even if what you're saying is bollocks, at least it looks the part.
As long as I've got good hand gestures for people watching on YouTube, and I can command the conversation using those, we should be right.
Like a guy doing the weather, like a weather guy. So we've got a cold front moving in from the north and some interesting points coming in from the south. So obviously you are now subscribed to my newsletter, like everybody else should be. And in it this week, I identified the percentage of Britons that thought they could beat different animals in a fight. So 45% of Brits think that they could beat a goose. 38% think that they could beat a medium-sized dog. 18% thought that they could beat an eagle, and then 5% thought that they could beat a kangaroo. What do you think's the largest animal that you could realistically beat in a fight?
Before we do that, we need to set the ground rules of what victory is.
The animal either runs away or it's dead, or it's immobilized.
Okay, because I'm a purple belt in jiu-jitsu. So, you know, if I take the back of a kangaroo and I've got a seatbelt under over, I've got, you know, control over that. I've got two hooks in behind the legs. No rotational control of the kangaroo. There's not going to be a verbal tap. So, you know.
So the kangaroo's dead.
I want to, no. I've just got control. I want to look at the adjudicator and be like, have I won? Because if you want me to kill this kangaroo, then, you know, that there's going to be a conflict of interest there. I don't think many people have been really looking at the rule set. Being a BJJ practitioner, I need to know the rules. Where am I going to accumulate points? With some animals, like a goose, I might pull guard, slide in on my bum, you know, take away the threat. Then that goose steps into the guard. Next thing you know, half guard, deep half, get a sweep, end up on top.
I think that most of these animals, the advantage comes from behind. But the problem is, especially with a goose and a kangaroo, their reach, you're going to have to try and fight the reach. Because kangaroos do that sort of double, like the drop kick thing. And that's going to be challenging for you, because you're not going to be used to striking at BJJ.
That's okay, because I'll catch the leg that they kick with, and then we'll do a run the pipe, which is a wrestling move, to sit them down. So, you know, I reckon I could have a few animals.
What about an eagle?
Again, the size discrepancy, I wouldn't really know how to go about it, and I wouldn't want to hurt the eagle either. So, you know, when it comes to altercations, I still think I'd probably end up running away. But I'm not sure, if I'm honest. Mm. I probably want, you know, if I could fight any animal, actually, no, I'd say a monkey, but they're way too strong. So I don't know, if I'm honest. I'm really not sure.
66% of Brits think that they could beat a house cat, which means that 34% think that the house cat would win. That really concerns me. Like, a cat is literally designed to be drop kicked over a fence. Like, it's the exact size. It's the perfect distance off the ground. If you can get it laterally, how far do you reckon you could kick a cat?
20 meters.
Easily. Yeah.
Have you heard of the saying that a dead cat still bounces?
Yeah. I don't know what it means, though.
So, like, when people are on their way out of success, right, they say, like, you know, you could still book them for an event. You know, let's say you find someone from a hit TV. What was Too Hot to Handle, yep, right? The first season. You could still get one from someone from season one, put them in a nightclub in Windsor, and they would still sell tickets. They're a dead count. A dead cat, it would still bounce if you drop it from enough height.
Okay.
So no matter how far it falls, it's still going to bounce. And the kind of adage, as I believe it, is that, yeah, you can still get a dead cat to bounce if you drop it from enough height.
Did you know that the terminal velocity of a cat is non-fatal?
That's that would make a lot of sense, seeing as they've jumped from buildings, and it's mad. Have you seen, there was a video on the internet the other day of a guy jumping out of a window of like a fourth, fifth story floor, hit the deck hard, and just got up and legged it.
What did he land on? Like grass or pavement?
It's like grassy kind of slippery slope onto concrete, but his butt hit the ground. Like, if he broke his tailbone, it wouldn't have surprised me.
Yeah.
But the adrenaline, he just got up and run. And the police officers come around a few minutes later and they're like, no way. No one could have survived that. It was like some parkour shit. You know, when you see him leap from buildings and then just land and roll. But yeah, getting back to your question, if it was first blood, then a cat could win versus a human quite quick.
Little needle claws.
Yeah, I've invented something called dog guard, which is when I sit on the floor and I try and take a dog's back, because of the nature of them having four legs. It is, and you don't want to hurt the dog. There are certain techniques you need to use when fighting with animals. But
what different breeds of dogs have you tried this on?
Labrador mostly. I know RSPCA, they're ready right now.
Yeah.
Ready to get us incriminating ourselves. The thing is, if you drive your car later and accidentally hit a cat, they'll come for you.
But
and they'll say this was premeditated.
Okay. But if you submit a Labrador, as long as it's adjudicated and the Labrador's signed a form of consent, then it's actually fine.
Yeah, absolutely fine.
Cool. I actually think that there's probably a potential future for this sport. All right, so you're back from Australia now. How are you finding it in the UK?
Do you know what? One of the things that I'm celebrating about being back is the caliber of great guests that I can talk to on podcasts.
You're saying that Australia doesn't have any interesting people in it, James?
I've just been through them all. No, I'm not saying that. Like,
well, yeah, but then there's the guests as well.
In Australia, there's certainly a more limited pool, let's say, especially of people that really interest me. And it's very great to be in London where I see that someone's in London. Hey, can we do a podcast? In the last 4 days, I've had two black belt world champions come on the podcast. Braulio Estima, and then this morning, Fionn Davies. I was like, in what world can you just message two world champions to come on and have a chat? So that I'm very grateful for. The fact we're fully open, Australia's now in full lockdown, is great. And it's good to be back and see family as well. Do you know what's really bad? People say from a psychological standpoint, when you're asked to answer a question in like bullet points, often it's in the hierarchy of importance in your mind. So James obviously likes his podcast guests a lot more than he likes his family.
That's funny. What about Australia? Because you'll have friends and ex-housemates and stuff that are still over there. What are they saying it's like?
Pretty miserable at the moment, where obviously we're only ever showing like the behind the scenes kind of highlight reels of what's actually going on there. So people are going to be like, oh, we're down the beach, sunny day, blue skies or whatever. But for a lot of them, they can't train. They've got no sport. They're confined to their houses. There are helicopters going around saying, go inside. Military have been deployed to Sydney to keep people inside. The fines have gone up to like £2,500.
I saw some bulleted list the other day saying that you can get huge fines for lying about your whereabouts, lying about contact tracing.
Yeah, and there's you're not allowed within a 5 kilometer radius of where you live. So even if you go to exercise and do
not stuff, allowed outside of a 5 kilometer radius of where you live.
Yeah. So like
within a 5 kilometer radius would be very difficult because then you'd never be able to go home. You'd just have all of these different people like circling apartment blocks.
Yeah, they can do that, but like if you're going to say a shop, a Woolworths that's really far away, they'll go, that's not within 5 kilometers where you live. That's not permitted. So it's very draconian, and it must be quite upsetting to know that you're 18, 19 months into a pandemic and you're effectively at day zero. I mean, the vaccine uptake is about 25% at the moment.
Why do you think that is?
I think that Australia didn't feel enough pain from the pandemic, if I'm honest. I think that pain is one of the most powerful motivators once you experience trauma and pain, some people fold from it, but other people grow from it. And in the UK, there was so much pain, trauma, lockdown. The vaccination was, understandably the way out, and people took it. They didn't want to exist in.
Do you see the vaccine as folding or growing from it?
In what sense? What do you mean?
Well, you said that there's two ways that people respond to pain. One of them's folding and one of them's growing. And you mentioned that the vaccine is one of the outcomes of that. Do you see the vaccine as somebody folding from the trauma or somebody growing from the pain?
I actually think it's growing because it's a risk. People are saying, okay, you know, even I thought my perspective on the vaccine and the criticisms of it, I thought that gave us a position to be quite valiant with it. Hey, you've got something that you're saying is going to get me out of this. Everyone else is unsure. Put it in my arm. And I mean, the people that participate in those trials, like that is extraordinary, nobility from people to go there and say, you know, I don't care what you're saying, put that in my arm. We can get out of this pandemic. Half of them got a placebo. And I think it's very valiant just the way that these communities have come together to go do it. I was nervous getting the vaccine because of the misinformation that is touted. And I'm rather evidence-based with my thinking, I believe anyway. And I was still nervous going there. And I was looking at the sheet of potential side effects. And I'll never forget, I had a client in the gym, a very wealthy guy, and he was overworked, stressed. And his wife said to me, "You will never train my husband unless he has a heart attack." Then he has a scare and he comes in the next week. He goes, "All right, I had a bit of a heart attack. I'm going to start training."
A bit of a heart attack.
Bit of a heart attack, or at least a bit of a scare. And he trained with me, but he didn't really sort his life out. And as a consequence, he suffered Bell's palsy, where the side of his face collapsed. And he comes in and he goes, "I've got £2 million in my current account, but I can't fix this." And that resonated with me so much, that you can't buy your way out of, you know, poor health isn't always visible, but something like that, which can happen to healthy people, don't get me wrong. That was, you know, just randomly for that to happen. He was like, doctors weren't sure exactly what the causation was. But I was thinking, imagine if that had happened today. And he's about 50, 60, so he would have been vaccinated. 100% he's going to go, "Look what the vaccine did to my face." And we've suddenly lost all logical thought processes surrounding bad things happening to people pre-vaccine. You know, Bell's palsy occurs. Adults randomly die sometimes. Some of the stuff going on online of people having like seizures, this happened before vaccines exist. And then people go, "She was perfectly fit and healthy. She went and got the vaccine. 2 weeks later, this is what's happening." And celebrities are sharing it. I'm seeing it and I'm shitting myself. I'm like, "Oh no, my vaccine's booked in 2 days."
I've had friends who've had to go for therapy before they've got their vaccine. They've had to go and sit down with a therapist so that they wouldn't be so nervous. They wouldn't have an anxiety attack going in to get it. But that's a really interesting narrative that very few people have been talking about. Everyone that's been very anti-vaccine has seen themselves as standing up to the man, that this is the courageous, valiant thing to do. But what you highlighted there, there's something called the tragedy of the commons that you get with the free rider problem. So herd immunity is required for us to reach it in order for the economy to be opened back up. If the deaths and the cases were linked the same as they'd been a year ago, the UK would still be in lockdown. The only reason that we're now back open is because the deaths have reduced. The reason that the deaths have reduced is because everybody's vaccinated. That's what's decoupled cases from mortality, because you get a lower infection load, so on and so forth. So you were totally correct. If you are someone that says, "Okay, I understand that in order to get this country back moving, in order to make other people who maybe can't get the vaccine to get their lives safe, I need to do something which I know has an associated risk with it, and I'm going to take on that cost." But what you get is this free rider problem, where the person who decides to just hold out and not get the vaccine and not get the vaccine and not get the vaccine ends up benefiting from herd immunity just as much as the person who does, but they don't have to take on some of the potential risks that come associated with the side effects of it. So that free rider problem turns a lot of the narratives that people have had upside down. It's like, okay, so who's the valiant one? Like, if I'm scared of taking the vaccine, if I know that there are some potential health risks, the same ones that you do, but I'm prepared to go, "Okay, I'm going to stick this in my arm so that we can get the country back moving, so that we can get the economy back working, so that people who can't get the vaccine can actually feel a little bit more safe." Like my cleaner can't get the vaccine because she's got some ongoing health concerns. So the only way that she could have come back to work in my house is if everybody in this house had got the vaccine. I didn't just get it for the cleaner, but that's an example.
There's also a lot of virtue signaling that's going on from people not getting the vaccine. And you're like, "Whoa, you're not better than people because you've stood up to the man." But in Australia, it's very interesting, because when I left Queensland, so you look in Brisbane, Gold Coast, Noosa, had only experienced, I think, 6 or 9 COVID deaths the entire pandemic. The whole time. New South Wales, maybe 200. The entire pandemic. Crazy. We had 70, 80 days with no cases in transmission. So like, we were like, "Oh yeah, COVID, you know, you wouldn't have any..." The statistical chances of me getting COVID in Australia were so small because no one had it. There were no transmissions in the community. I actually got a really bad cold. And when I got a really bad cold, I was like, "No way I'm getting tested." Because if I get tested and it turns out I'm one of 5 million people that have got COVID, I'm done. I'll get cancelled.
Out of the country, yeah.
Yeah, they were like, "James Smith, dirty COVID bastard." There's almost like shaming. Like, over here, you get tested, fine, it's normal. It's like, you know, anything. It's just like, "Oh, Dave's got COVID. Oh, has he? I thought he had it already." In Australia, when I got the sniffles, I was like, "It's best not be COVID." You know, and I joked around and said to people, like, if chlamydia went away in 2 weeks, you'd never get tested. You just do your own thing, keep your dick in your pants, and you'd be fine. Right. And someone's like, "Give me chlamydia." No, I didn't. "Don't know what you're on about. You got it from someone else." And so I think because of that, because the problem wasn't so severe you didn't know anyone that died of COVID in Australia, your friends, your family, very rarely. Some people are going to go, oh, what about the old people? I'm a 30-year-old that lives in Sydney. I don't know any 90-year-olds. My family are all in the UK. So there wasn't enough trauma for people to be motivated to do it. And the Premier of Queensland actually came out and said, I'm not anti-vax, but so far, I think the AstraZeneca is causing blood clots in 1 in 10,000. If you put that across the population of Queensland and the fact we've only had 6 or 9 deaths, statistically, we're going to have 20 more deaths from the vaccine than we will COVID.
Fucking hell.
And she was completely right.
Yeah.
So you've got that as far as a political kind of problem. Australia is still aiming for a zero COVID, you know, country, which it's very difficult with the variants, hotel quarantine, the draconian nature of that. Olympians coming back from Tokyo, if you live in South Australia, you've had to quarantine twice. 2 weeks in Sydney, fly to Adelaide, and 2 weeks in South Australia. 28 fucking days. And now, am I mental here? Are we not in a position where we can get 100% COVID test in a quarantine environment within a shorter period than 14 days? And some people are like, oh, but some people don't have symptoms until day 10 or whatever. Take a pint of my blood, right? Do what you need to do. But if you can determine I've not got it, let me the fuck out. You know what I mean?
Well, I had a couple of friends who were comedians that went over to go and do tours, and they had to do the same thing. And you just watch someone slowly descend into madness as they went over and spent all of their time in this hotel being delivered sort of prefabricated meals that were already made there. Thankfully, they've got a few of them have got quite big followings, so they'd managed to get fans to come and throw weed onto their balcony from a park that was down below. Some people were coming and throwing like bags of weed and sweets and like cans and other stuff up onto the balcony. But yeah, I don't know, man. It's
you can deliver food to the actual place and say, can you take this up? So for instance, you get Uber Eats and Deliveroo. So that comes into the reception, it goes straight up. So if you have a food delivery for a friend, you could put weed brownies, so I've heard, in a bag, give it to your friend. So I've heard, and the hotel will take it right up to their room. So
imagine that, just 14 days, absolutely baked out of your mind. You just come out as a vegetable. No COVID, Duren, though.
Duren went in and he did 14 days to come out for our Australia shows. He grew 70,000 followers. He became the everyone wanted to know how he was losing his mind. And for him, he's a very disorganized person. Being in the same room for 2 weeks was perfect for him. He really enjoyed it.
Constrained all of the things that he was getting wrong in his normal life.
Two of my friends were literally day 13. They were like, I'm not sure I'm ready to leave. You know that.
I've got Stockholm syndrome. Keep me in here.
Exactly. Yeah. They actually genuinely felt like that. For me, like going back and having to sit in a hotel room for 2 weeks, as long as there's like Australia on the other side and I get to go out and jump in the beach at Bondi, that's fine. But the people having to do it, come back to the UK, having to do it in like an Ibis in Heathrow, not the most glamorous of kind of scenarios, but it's quite depressing. I know that some people in Australia wanted to travel to New Zealand where their parents were very in poor bids of health. There was a case of one girl who asked if she could go back and see her mum because her mum was dying. And while New Zealand said, you've got to quarantine. And as she was quarantined, her mum died. So she said, can I come out and go see her? They said, no. There was a chance she was going to miss her mum's funeral, but they managed to push the funeral back a little bit later. And then she went to her mum's funeral and then had to do 2 weeks on the way back. So she's a month away from her partner. You've got people suffering with bereavement, loss of loved ones. And so many people forget that isolation is the worst punishment given to human beings. If you go to prison and Charles Bronson done like the most amount of solitary confinement. If you are the worst treated person or you're the worst person on the planet, you are solitary confined. And now we are dishing out months and years of solitary confinement to people in prevention of spreading a virus that's already in the country.
But the alternative is to let it run rampant, right? It's difficult from a policy perspective to just say, oh, well, we'll let it out. People don't need to do the quarantine because you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. Like, this is one of the situations. The only people apparently that knew exactly what policies should have been done are the press commenting on something that happened 4 weeks ago, like perpetually. Over the last 18 months, they always had the right answer, but not at the time. They had it in retrospect after a month. You're like, well, do you really think that the people in charge of your country want more people to die?
Like how? Yeah, mate, I'm sure that some of the people at the top, probably psychopaths and sociopaths and people that don't have empathy, have snuck through. But like, en masse? Like the entire global leadership is just trying to decimate their own countries?
It's more so the fact that there's no kind of lateral thinking with this. Like, I would happily wear an ankle tag and be on house arrest. I would pay a security a very good wage for 2 weeks to stand at my front door and to make sure I don't fucking leave. I'll pay that guy £200 a day. Just let me be in a home. Just let me have a garden. Let me have somewhere to sit. Let me employ someone to make sure I don't leave the house. You know what I mean? Put cameras out, put a tag on me, whatever, but let me live like a human. You know, to not get fresh air is one of my weirdest concerns. We did an event in Leeds last week, and there was a room between the backstage area and the main stage area, and it had no ventilation in it because it was a really old building. And I felt claustrophobic in it, and it was a big room. And I said, is no one else bothered that there's no fresh air in here? Like, there's no ventilation. I panic in those kind of environments. And when you get into hotels where there's no window to open, for a few hours, fine. To sleep, fine. But 2 weeks without having fresh air come in, I already worry what that's going to make me feel like. And some celebrities, if you go, there was some Geordie Shore cast that went out and they had outdoor balconies, seating areas. They had rooms all next to each other so they could see each other. Poor Charlotte from Geordie Shore flew out for 2 weeks, quarantine, then the show got binned because of their outbreak and had to come back.
Yeah. Fucked it. Fully fucked it.
Yeah. So it's quite annoying that it's a rule for one and different rule for another, and you've kind of got to have contacts and TV if you want to have a balcony. Like, who have I got to suck off to get a fucking balcony? Let me know.
If you can't do it, no one can.
Exactly. The SAS boys got rowing machines on their balconies. I'd like that, but just I probably wouldn't use it.
Another thing that I've been really fascinated by recently is sort of modern dating dynamics, especially in the era of Love Island and Instagram and Tinder. Relationships seem so interesting to me, especially as women start to be more educated and outperform men in employment. What have you been thinking about to do with this? You noticed anything interesting?
From a dating dynamic, do you know what? I know you've had him on the podcast before, Jordan Peterson, the kind of insight that he has about intelligent women being harder to settle up. They're less inclined to get married because for a woman, it is often a prerequisite to have a husband who is more intelligent. That's what they would like and what they would seek. And the more intelligent a woman, the smaller the pool for potential partners as a counterpart. However, for men, they do not have that same prerequisite in the other direction because they have this macho kind of, you know, sense of providing and looking after. Now, there are going to be some people that disagree with that. You're going to have outliers, but that's pretty much it.
On average.
On average, yeah. So now that, you know, that's just something, a dynamic I never really thought about before. Do you know what? Since we've last spoken, I actually read a book called Attached. Have you read this?
No.
So one of my ex-girlfriends told me to read it. Shona.
Fantastic.
And I left it unread for a very long time. One of my housemates had the physical hard copy. And when I got back, I said, right, okay, I'm going to listen to it. And I listened to it, started running. And it's been criticized for not having enough categories. But you have secure, then you have avoidant, then you have anxious. So you've got these three broad categories. And when the traits were explained, I knew straight away I was avoidant. Straight away. And I've never felt like I've been spoken to in a book before. All my traits. And secure people aren't very omnipresent in the dating scene because they're in relationships, because they're secure. So if you go onto a dating app, I've now come to realize the majority of people are either anxious or avoidant. Now, if I start chatting to an avoidant person, we're probably not even going to kick off because we're both avoidant. There's not enough there. Now, if I end up finding a secure person, often there's not enough fireworks and you think they're quite boring and you go straight past a partner that would have been a good idea. And I've now come to realize that a lot of people that I know that are in successful long-term relationships, the beginning of their relationship was never special. They were friends, or they went on a few dates, or they hung out, or they played at the same rugby club. And then over time, it's only month 2, 3, and 4, they realize how perfect they are for each other. Then you've got this poisonous, avoidant and anxious connection, where if you put an avoidant and anxious person together, there's fireworks in the onset. And I've realized so many of my previous relationships, I've dated anxious women. And it's like two ends of a magnet that shouldn't be together. And I spot this now when I look at my friends. If an anxious person is feeling unloved, this is my understanding anyway, they partake in something called protesting behavior. And when they partake in protesting behavior, they cause an argument out of something that never had grounds for an argument. And they create this kind of protest because they want to feel loved by the other person. They need reconfirmation of the other person's love for them. But as an avoidant attachment style myself, when I see that protesting behavior, I distance myself from it. I'm like, whoa, you're acting a bit crazy. You know, I'm like, whatever, you know, what are you doing? So the avoidant person becomes more detached. The anxious person becomes more crazy trying to get the reaction. And you kind of drift further apart. And then the avoidant person just disconnects, and the relationship goes to shit. And that is literally probably the last four serious relationships I've had. And I read this book and I was like, oh shit, I've been dating the wrong type of people.
It was all here. Yeah, but people confuse that sort of flirtation and the little bit of energy at the start for a spark, right? That the fact that you have a little bit of friction that can cause heat. This person's interesting, they challenge me, there's something different about them. And then down the line you think, well, this is fun for dating, but do I actually want to roll this into a long-term relationship with someone that we're constantly at each other's throats?
It's a really difficult pill to swallow to realize that the onset of a relationship of someone who's not right for you is amazing. And then it dies out. And often the onset of a relationship where someone's amazing for you feels quite dull. And people, if they're in a stage of their life where they're dating, they might just cast them aside and move on to something that feels better. And a friend of mine called me this morning, really angry about a disagreement he'd had with a girl he's seeing. And I said, you're an anxious person. You're partaking in protesting behavior. And I said, you haven't got the reaction you want from her. And now you're mad and venting to me. I go, the fact you're speaking to me is because you're so annoyed she hasn't given you the reaction you want. And I was like, fuck, I've read one book about dating and I'm already now seeing things differently. You know, like when the first time you find out about macros, protein, carbs, fat, it's like I look at things like that now. I'm like, I see the code. I see the numbers.
Yeah, the red pills, pure red pill shit.
So that helped me understand a lot about myself, really, and the dating scene where I am avoidant. And I have a theory that being successful in whatever line of work you do gives you a permit to be extra avoidant, because if something's not working out or there's an argument or I start distancing myself from someone because they're protesting or they're annoying or there's no compatibility, similar to yourself, we have work we can fall back on, a constant variable that's always there supporting us. And you're seeing someone right now, right?
Correct.
Let's say she starts making your life hell. The demons occur in your head going, fuck you. If I get rid of you, I could do an extra podcast every day. I can develop my business, what I do, and my legacy if I eradicate you and replace it with work.
But there's a comfort zone there, right? There's always this fallback plan. There's always something there that you know that you've got going on. It's actually kind of like being in two relationships at once.
It is.
It's like being in a relationship with the person that you're seeing and also being in a relationship with your work. And knowing that if that one starts to piss you off, that you've got something that you can put your love and your energy and your attention into, and you will get love and energy and attention back. And I think that it makes for a very interesting dynamic when you have somebody that doesn't need the partner. And I suppose that a lot of attachment probably comes from a place of insecurity. And also, if your ego gets hurt a little bit and you don't want to swallow that, you can just quite quickly, even if it's not an insecurity, you can just think, well, fuck it, I'm just going to focus on something that I actually can predict, because that was completely irresponsible of them to say.
Yeah, and then you can, such as myself, go and put out good content, make video, and you can get your almost addictive dopamine serotonin hits from a digital device, which is fucked. Now I'm in a position where, you know, I could go cold shoulder on the person who's giving me grief, where really in a relationship, argument should be a time where, you know, a bit like training a muscle. You create damage, it comes back stronger. Create damage, come back stronger, and you're progressively overloading. And that trauma that occurs is a part of the growing process. But it becomes so easy when you are, you know, successful in your own right, when you're working for yourself, let's say, actually, because that's probably the metric of success I'm using. So easy to just turn your way on that and go to the other relationship. And then you go, oh, and this is the dangerous assumption. You're like, if I do that and make more money and get more successful, I can set up for my future life, my future wife, my future this. And having, talking about a utopian version of a future wife is a classic trait of an avoidant attachment style. And I was like, when I was at that, I was like, oh, fuck.
Wanting to move back to Australia, build the business, get the family, buy the dog, do the this thing. They're all justifications for why you don't need to put up with difficulties in the now.
And that is classic avoidance style. And it, I thought that was just me. And then I realized that everyone of the same attachment style is the exact same. And I was like, fuck. And I've actually used that sometimes to create distance between former lovers where I think, oh, my future wife ain't going to act like that. She isn't going to say that. She isn't going to behave like that. Go on, get out of here. You know what I mean? So I realized that a lot of these kind of flaws that exist in my thinking towards relationships is based on how I am. And that apparently is governed from how you're brought up. But you need to have variation in attachment styles as part of like evolutionary kind of traits. You need these kind of outliers who, if I always think as if I was a primitive human, I was like, I'll be out killing wildebeest and shit, bringing back legs of meat and pillaging through all the women in the camp. You know, like I probably would quite like to just go hunt on my own. And I was like, that's probably why I'm, you know, I like working on my own. I'm very much an ambivert. I have my extrovert moments, I have my introvert moments. And in the digital age with social media, it's never been easier to be, you know, introverted and avoidant and still yet hit quotas and all the things that...
But you get to be extroverted on your own terms. You get to pick when it is that you do it. This is one of the reasons why I love doing the podcast, that if I was... I'm good buddies with Mike Thurston, as an example, and he's pretty much constantly vlogging. If he wants to put out 2 or 3 videos a week, he actually needs to capture quite a lot of content. He needs to do shit. Like, he can't just sit down and have a conversation. Like, he actually has to do shit. He has to go on a boat or go to the gym with Larry Wheels or fucking do whatever, buy a new car. So he has to do stuff, and he's constantly on, always, always on. But that suits his personality type because he's sort of this quite gregarious, outgoing sort of like dude who's super extroverted and always has buddies around him. I'd be like, fuck, man, like I need... So last week I was in London and I did Rebel Wisdom on Wednesday. I did Lotus Eaters podcast on Friday. I spent a full day with my buddy Alex O'Connor, Cosmic Skeptic, on another day. And then on Saturday I did GB News. It's like I literally, for the first time in as long as I can remember, I spent 4 days and maybe like an hour a day waking was on my own. And the rest of the time was around other people. And I came back on Saturday night and I was completely wrecked. Like this is... I mean, it was awesome and fun, but I needed that time to sort of rest and recuperate. And yeah, designing your life and whatever your creative pursuits are and the job that you have and the sort of partner that you're with around, okay, where do I get my energy from? Do I have a partner who constantly needs me? If I'm someone who actually enjoys their time on their own, then that's not going to work because I'm always going to feel like they're pushing and they're being needy when I actually just require a bit of space.
I think that reading that book and really thinking about what I'd learned, I've realized that the real issue is that I've never communicated my requirements and needs to be on my own. And if I'd communicated that better, when I had gone to that place of needing to be on my own, the partner I was with wouldn't have felt unloved because they would have justification.
This is why it's happening.
Yeah. So I think that next time I'm in that kind of place, I need to say to someone, hey, look, I need time on my own now and then. And do you know what? A lot of the times that my relationships have combusted is when I've spent too much time with people trying to please them, you know, letting them stay around all the time because it's convenient for their gym routine, letting them stay around because, you know, of whatever it is. And then I've realized that I've been neglecting my own attachment style in a bid to make someone else happy. And because of that, it's just blown the relationships up. And now in retrospect, I can see that my most successful relationships are when my girlfriends live further from me. And I was like, fuck. I was like, I'm going to need some fucking good therapy if I'm going to move in with someone.
I know, man. Well, there's a few things that I've been reading about recently. One of them's the cohabitation effect, which you may be familiar with. If you live with somebody who you are intending on getting married with for more than 6 months before the marriage, there's a statistically significant increase in the chances of divorce. So most people, this goes against what most people would think. You move in together, you work out if you're compatible, and then you make the relationship down the line more likely to work. But there's something going on, and there's a bunch of different theories. One of them is this open door policy. The presumption is that if you decide to live with somebody before you've committed to them legally and made it marriage material, you're basically saying you're good enough for now. you're good enough right now, but I'm not going to commit just yet. We're living together, but I'm not going to commit just yet. And that there's this sort of subtext that comes through. And there's a whole bunch of other suggestions, but that's one of them. Another one that I've read about is that in a relationship where the woman out earns the man, there is a 50% increase in chances of divorce. There is also a 25% increase in the chances that the man needs to use Sildenafil or Viagra to perform in bed. And the final one was, if you have a master's level education versus a bachelor's, there's a 93% increase in right swipes on Tinder.
Really?
Yeah. One year of your life. Just lads, if you're listening, if you're 21 and considering going on to do a master's, increase, even if you're not bothered about the degree, 93% increase in right swipes on Tinder. Or just lie about it. I mean, that's an alternative.
Is that in the profile where it talks about education, or is that just from how the person dresses, persona?
No, it would be in the, I think it would be stipulated in the profile description.
Oh, then fucking lie about it. I lied about having a BSc for fucking 4 years in the corporate world. they just wanted someone with a BSc. They wanted someone with that attitude. And I had that attitude when I was at work, but I only got a foundation degree, which is degrees. But then I think that men hugely underestimate the sapiosexual nature of women as well.
What's that mean?
People that are sexually attracted to people with intelligence. Mm-hmm. Sapiosexual. That's when I'm presenting a talk and I do something that's really kind of profound and there's silence as they're absorbing it, I'm like, yeah, ladies, the term is sapiosexual if you're finding me attractive right now. But I guarantee that the women, I think, and again, people say, oh, why is a man explaining how women feel? And if you do feel that way, fuck off. I've dated women for fucking 15, 16 years. I think I have an insight to it.
I've made a lot of mistakes. I have a very, very good insight into what women do and don't like in relationships. I've
dated more women than most women, so relax, all right? And I would say that women are attracted to wit and banter and all of this, but I think it's because if you look across the scale of things, funny people are intelligent, very intelligent. I think the people that have got witty, quick banter, even the fact that you could get a joke around quick, people see that as a source of intelligence.
It's an immediate demonstration of intellect, correct.
And that must be, an element of sexual attraction, because not only do you want the kind of physical, traits in someone and testosterone profiles, androgens, growth hormone, reproductive, whatever, you also want someone who's intelligent. And the same goes more so for women than men go for women. But then again, that's often misconstrued that men obviously then don't find intelligence attractive and they just want tits or ass or whatever fucking Middle England likes to put in your questions box. You know, hey guys, ask me anything, intellectual level, tits or ass. You're like, fucking hell.
That was something I found really weird. So when I went on Love Island first season and they said, what's your type? What they were asking was, do you like petite girls? Do you like brunettes? Do you want green eyes or brown eyes? Do you want her to dress like this? They weren't asking, what are the fundamental characteristics that are going to never change across time? They were saying, what are the physical characteristics that are going to fade within the next 8 years? That's what they were asking.
That's a very dangerous kind of question as well, when you put it like that, fade over the next 8 years. And another phenomenon is the amount of people that I've met and found them very sexually attractive after a couple of hours and thought, wow, if I'd only seen a screenshot of you, I might not have swiped right on you. Alternatively, the polar opposite, where I've swiped right on someone based on their picture and met them and there's been nothing.
So this is something that the incel community has a huge problem with at the moment. So recently we had that shooting in not Newquay, in Plymouth. I got shouted at for putting Newquay in the newsletter by someone from Plymouth, by someone from Newquay, and said that I'd offended their entire town. One of the problems that the incel community has is that online dating platforms like Tinder has allowed women to constrain their potential dating pool with what are essentially arbitrary metrics. So they can say on certain dating platforms, apparently you can put in your height and then you can also restrict your matches by height. So if you're a 5'8" guy and the woman says nobody below 5'10", you do not get a look in with that woman. But what it misses off, and the argument from the incel community, is that there are X factors, grace, you know, the way that somebody moves, like the fact that they have good body language, all of these things that you cannot put your finger on. And these aren't quantified on an app. Now, something tells me that the incel community isn't exactly swimming in X Factor and grace, but the argument still makes sense.
When I first started online personal training before I had an app, I would get my clients, as soon as they paid, I would send them a video. I go, hey, thank you very much for joining my online personal training platform. Really excited to get working with you. I require you to send me a video back. For the first 6 months, I just started chatting to them, but I didn't know them. That one video that they would send me, they'd be like, hi, my name's Trisha, or whatever it was. I could see their level of anxiety, their way that they held themselves, the way they spoke. And that gave me a good idea of building their program. And if they seemed like very anxious and very, their hand shaking, no camera presence, I was like, probably not going to have a squat rack in their first phase of programming. Because if they are nervous holding up a phone to me, I'm not sending them into the depths of the squat rack. And then alternatively, if someone was bubbly like, hi, James, yeah, so I do group classes every week. I'm like, she's going to be fine going in. It was amazing that just 45 seconds of someone on camera, I could develop an assumption for who they were and what they were like. And where I have used dating apps before with caution, one of the first things I do when I take the conversation to WhatsApp is that I want to see you speak. I want to see you. And there's often an unfair fucking balance if they follow me on Insta. Because I was like, hey, here's 400 hours of me chatting shit. I just want a fucking 30-second WhatsApp video to make sure that you're not face-tuned and fucking, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting one. We were talking as well before we recorded about the interesting lack of a stereotype or an archetype for a young guy in his 30s who isn't married, doesn't yet have a family, but can't wait to be a dad. I'm fascinated by this. I think it's such an interesting time for men who perhaps have freedom and liberty to do what they want with their life. Maybe they've got more resources than they actually need. And from the outside, you look at those guys and it would be the Dan Bilzerians of the world. That's like the archetype of the guy in his 30s or 40s who's still sort of got it all. But I think both me and you agree, like, I can't wait to be a dad. Like, I actually cannot wait to become a father. I think I'm going to be an awesome father. I think I would have sucked as a dad at 23, 24 years old. I would have been like just awful. Like, there should be some sort of license that you need or like some sort of test that you have to pass, and I would not have passed.
You have to fucking test to drive a car. Why can't you do it?
to have a kid.
You could do a lot more damage to the community with the family than you are with the car.
Correct. And yeah, I just think it's such an interesting sort of time to be alive where you've got these sort of dynamics, this sort of freedom and no archetype for a man. A woman hits 30 and everybody sort of starts side-eyeing her about, oh, sort of TikTok, biological clock, when you're going to get married. But for men, it's like, oh, go on, mate. Like, you must be loving it, still being free and liberty and stuff like that. And you're like, well, kind of. But on the flip side, I also want a family.
Yeah. And I think there's another interesting statistic that I always keep in mind, that the average guy marries a woman 4 years younger. The average woman marries a guy 4 years older. Another Peterson one. I'm so glad I hadn't read his stuff before I wrote my book. Otherwise, it would be so Peterson leaning. Yeah. But yeah, it's so interesting you kind of say about that. And I did a psychedelic trip earlier on this year and did some mushrooms, sat on the edge of a cliff in North Bondi and just thought about life, listening to some Hans Zimmer. And when you take psychedelics, and a lot of your ego is stripped away, because I find that having a certain amount of money, certain amount of recognition, success in whatever fields really shrouds your vision from often your values that sit underneath it.
What actually matters, yeah.
Yeah, and I was thinking, strip that away. What have I really got? And I had this conversation with Paul Lima a few weeks ago where I said, I sat there, the first thing I thought about, this is why I fucking love psychedelics. The first question that my mind put onto me was, do people like you for who you are or what you do? And I had to sit with that. And I was like, well, if you took away everyone that likes me for what I do, how many people like me for who I am as a percentage? Fractions of a percent, right? And I was like, oh, it's quite a tough pill to swallow. Sat with it for a few hours, went through the playlist. And then the second one was my family's biggest. If I was to say to my mom and dad, what are you most proud of in life? I think they would say me and my sister. No question about it. And I thought, I've come through that door, the family house, a lot of times in the last 10 years. And I'm sure they're chuffed to pieces with Sunday Times bestseller, you know, chuffed to pieces that you did this, came back first class from Sydney. I was like, and actually I bought my dad a Porsche, or I bought my family a Porsche earlier on this year. My dad picked me up from the airport in a rented van. And I was like, we've got to sort this out. So I bought him a Porsche, and he was chuffed to pieces. And he messages me on WhatsApp. He goes, son, I've never been so happy behind the wheel of a car. And I was like, that makes me feel proud. But I reckon the day I come home with the wife and kids, that's when they're going to be like, you've done it.
Made it.
Done it. And I was sitting back with that, and I was like, my parents are quite similar to me in the sense where they don't really care about flash items or big things. And my mum and dad don't travel. I can't even really take them on holiday. You know, even if I was to take them somewhere posh, it'd be like down the south coast in the UK, which you can't do in the pandemic, so everything's booked. You know, the happiest things for them in life is seeing my nephew, going to see my sister at work, going out for a Sunday roast or whatever. I was like, fuck, if I really want to impress the most important people in my life, I'm probably going to have a family. And I was like, what am I doing? If I was to, you know, look at a spider diagram of my life, there are some parts of it that are extremely successful, but other parts of it that are extremely lacking. And that psychological experience really got me thinking. And when I do talk to people, they're like, oh, mate, you must do so much shagging. Bet you get loads of birds. I'm like, hey, I'm actually trying to work and develop an area of my life that I'm lacking in. And like, I'm like, I'm trying. And it's tough because you do get pulled in so many directions and your mind wanders and you're like, oh, maybe I do want that. And then part of your mind goes, maybe you don't. Maybe you're designed not to, maybe you're not going to get on with it. My track record of relationships is dire.
Mine's like, not fantastic either, no.
But for some reason, there's this illusion in my mind that I'm just going to meet the one and then everything changes. But is that probably an illusion? Is that a utopian desire? Is, you know, am I so hardwired and programmed? I'm 32. My life revolves around my work, my routine and my training. It's going to take a lot of effort for me to change that up. And it's quite concerning. Like, we all just see a few years time with our family, wife and kids. There's a lot of work that needs to happen before that becomes a reality. And I think I'm quite negligent of giving enough mental attention to that amount of work required.
I think one of the challenges that everyone is going to have to come up against that's in that situation, you know, the PTs that are listening, the people that work for themselves, that run their own businesses, that do whatever, that feel liberated, you're going to have to concede that your performance at work will likely have to take a hit in order for you to have a family. Like, there is a price for you to pay. You know, if you want to court the girl of your dreams, if you want to start the family, if you want to you're going to have to take time off work. Like, what happens? Vast majority of people, anyone that's read The E-Myth by Michael Gerber, like, most people don't have a business. They have a highly leveraged solo pursuit. Like, if they left their business for 2 weeks, all hell would break loose. Like, that means you don't have a business. It's just you, but you're just leveraged a little bit more. And you're going to have to deal with that. You're going to have to deal with it existentially. You're going to have to deal with the ego. Like, okay, I'm not going to be able to post videos as frequently because I'm up at 4 a.m. looking after the kids, or I've got to support the wife, or we're in hospital in labor for fucking 48 hours or whatever whatever goes on. Like, these are things, these are prices that you need to pay. And if you've attached such a sense of self-worth and you've wrapped your ego around your success, your externalities of your success, I wonder how many people without the right amount of self-work will end up low-key resenting their family for taking away from them something that they previously used to get a sense of fulfillment from.
That's exactly the word I was about to bring in, is I'm worried about maybe a future self of resent, you know? Before this, I did more, I had more, could afford more, had more freedom. Like, having freedom's taken away. We've had a lot of that in the last couple of years. You know, this utopian desire of having a family, I'm like, oh, you know, could I flip a coin and be the other way around? I did a dangerous poll on Instagram once saying, if you could go back and have kids, would you have? And it was 50-50. 50% yes, 50% no. I was like, fuck.
Thanks for helping.
I was like, shit the bed. I was like, maybe I'll just be a solo warrior my whole life. But, you know, the funny thing is that we talk about Dan Bilzerian in my most recent, I won't give it away too much, in my most recent talk, I differentiate pleasure and happiness. I think Dan Bilzerian fills his life with tremendously high amounts of pleasure to fulfill just a speck of happiness. Whereas, you know, other people have no fucking pleasure at all. Their kids wake them up, and they fucking resent their wife. They fucking tired all the time, but they're happy. And there is going to have to be a trade-off at some point for a lot of people. I've done PT seminars before where people will say to me like, oh, wish I had what you had. I wish I had the free time. Wish I had this. And I'm like, you're married and you've got kids. They're like, yeah. I'm like, well, I've won some things. You've won others.
Yeah.
I was like, you probably wouldn't trade yours for mine. At this stage, I wouldn't trade mine for yours. None of us is a winner. There's no scale here. It's not like 100 grand in the bank equals the same pleasure as one kid.
Yeah. But that's the thing, man. Like, most people don't see the prices that you have to pay for success. And you said it earlier on, certain areas of your life have hypertrophied and other areas have sort of atrophied or maybe never even existed. And yet you don't see, like, I always use this example of Tiger Woods. Like, you don't know the price that Tiger Woods had to pay to be Tiger Woods. On the golf course, an absolute animal, perhaps one of the best ever. But I wouldn't take relationship advice from him. But I don't think that he's, you know, he's got such low self-worth that he's been pulled over at the side of the road for falling asleep at the wheel as he's on his medication. He recently rolled his car. I'm going to guess that he probably wasn't fully sober when he did that, and that snapped both his legs. He spent nearly half a decade out of the sport because he's had injuries, because he's pushed himself so hard, because that's what was drilled into him by his father. All right, do you want that? Like, do you really want that? Because everyone looks at him and thinks, oh, great, I'd love to be Tiger Woods, traveling the world, playing golf, night contract, all this money, adoration. Okay. Do you want to not be able to look yourself in the mirror? Do you want to not be able to love a wife? Do you want to not be able to stay faithful to one woman? Those are the prices that you have to pay. But because we applaud success and we put it on such a narrow domain, such a narrow channel, and we put it on such a high pedestal, you think, right, that's what I want, because that's what everybody else seems to think is cool to want. So therefore, everyone just starts mimetically copying whatever it is that's on the top of that. But the grass is always greener with this stuff. You know, me and you, two guys who could go anywhere in the world, could work from anywhere in the world, are both saying, ooh, isn't it interesting thinking about families? Like, wouldn't it be, I wonder if I'm going to be a good dad. Like, I wonder what sort of fucking, like, family SUV I'm going to, like, do you know what I mean? Like, what sort of stroller should we get? And the grass is fucking greener with this stuff. Like, to look at you and say, you've got it sorted, mate, is just, it's narrow-minded.
It's also, here's a +4 Uno card. I'm adopted as well. So I've never seen or been with or touched of a bloodline relative. So if I have a kid, that is going to be the only relative that's in my bloodline that I've ever seen.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so like that's another really crazy like plot twist on that, where people look around at their family, they can see their features and their parents and their sisters and everything. But I've never had that. So that's another kind of layer to it. And sometimes men right now are not in the best place they've ever been for fertility and for sperm count and for environments. Like, I'm pretty sure that as we go through the next 20, 30 years, where I think there'll be a natural decline of population due to the fact of women being more educated, contraception, yep, all of these things, more likely to be in professional work life. I think we're also seeing generations of less and less healthy men, and more obesity, more lack of sunlight, all of these things. And I sometimes worry about fertility, you know. Like, it's a weird thing that when I'm 32, I got hit in the nuts in jiu-jitsu the other day. I was like, don't do that again.
I haven't had kids yet. I was seriously thinking the other day, because someone had commented and said that the quality of male sperm decreases. So not, well, also the volume, but the quality in terms of fertility decreases in your late 30s. And I was thinking, I was going to Google it. Where can I freeze some jizz? Like, where can I freeze some? Just in case, just as an insurance policy.
It's a valid thing. It's 100% a valid thing. And like, yeah, like, because then I was thinking, I was like, if I was infertile, which people think is really rare, well, my mum and dad couldn't have kids. So I've lived and grown up with perfectly normal human beings that have got no ill bids of health. For the amount of wine they drink and the fact they've never been to a gym, they're fucking amazing, right? And they couldn't have kids. And I was like, fuck. And then I was like, imagine if I was in a position where I couldn't. That means that my bloodline would never, ever continue.
Yeah. There
would be, it's not like it could branch through, you know, my sister or anyone else or my parents or whatever. I was like, that's it done. The lone gene pool that existed through myself that never,
ever. 4 billion years of unbroken survival and reproduction.
Would die and end in that
full
position.
Stop.
Yeah. And I was like, that'd be shit. And then Paul Alima, one of my favorite people, I had him on the pod a few weeks ago. He nearly died of COVID. quite literally nearly died. And he has two daughters, loves them to pieces. And he said there was like a little bit of solace when he thought, when he was laying on the floor waiting for the ambulance to come get him. He was like, it's okay. They'll be fine.
The genetic prodigy has continued, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, there's something about that I don't think is really discussed about. It's not quite macho to really talk and epitomize reproduction. And there definitely is something in the body clock. Since 30 to 32, which annoyingly, my body clock and my broody nature has become a lot more intense since the pandemic.
Correct, same.
But at the same time, the freedom to roam, meet, fall in love and all of that has never been more shattered and separated and digital and soulless, and it's got so much worse. And for me, I have a great fucking fantastic life, and I'm very worried about other people that would be in this exact same existential anxiety of where the world's going and when things will be back to normal. And you know, how many people that would have been on fate's path to meet each other and fall in love and go on romantic trips and meet backpacking in Thailand, bump into each other in Split in Croatia, meet each other on a fucking boat at Sail Week. How many of those have just been squandered and ended up sitting on their fucking sofa watching Netflix instead? It's crazy that the dynamism of the human kind of petri dish has been frozen for 2 years. And I feel like I'm in the middle of it. And I feel like age is just ticking away. I was 30 when this pandemic started. I'm now 32. And I don't like that.
Hormones are a hell of a drug, man. I was saying this the other day to Carl Benjamin down south. He's got 3 kids and like a fourth on the way. My business partner's missus is 3 days overdue on their first daughter. They got 2 boys. Their first daughter's on like literally fucking in the oven, ready to be taken out now. And for years, kids were the things that stopped my friends from seeing me on a Saturday when I wanted to go out and have breakfast and I was hungover or whatever. They made too much noise when I was on a plane and I was trying to sleep, and they were just sort of icky and they got in the way. And now I look at young kids, toddlers or babies, and I'm like, bet you're cool.
Yeah.
I bet you do like quite fun stuff. I'm like, whoa, who's this? Like, who's this existing inside of this head? Like, get out. Like, you weren't here before. I don't know who you are.
It's interesting as well. Then you've got this huge kind of utopian picture of meeting the woman and there being a perfect time for her to be the mother of your kids or a wife. And this is a gray area as well. Anyone you meet that's happily married or has kids, there was never a right time. If you were to ask me about business and ask me when the right time is, I'm like, there's never a right time. Just fucking do it. Correct the course along the way.
In relationships, you're unable to take that same advice. Yeah, but I'll just hang fire for the next one. Maybe the problem's her again.
Yeah, that's it. And it's relationships, I'm very fixed. Business, I'm very growth. So I've got similar mind, or completely different mindsets. And like, if anyone says things, I'm launching a business, I'd say if you're ready for the business, you launch too late. But then in a relationship, whoa.
Yeah, hold on, boys.
And like, I suppose to add on top of that, I know that myself and probably thousands of British and Irish people in Australia are struggling with visa status. And
you don't even know if you're going to be able to go back properly, right?
Yeah, I'm in limbo at the moment. And for 4 years now, 4 years, which is over 10% of my life, I feel like a plane circling, ready to land. That's how I felt, because I want to live in Australia. I do not want to live in the UK. I do not want to have a serious relationship in the UK. So that's another thing. So if someone here was like, James, let's go on a date, I'd be like, well, I really don't want this to work out. I've already decided in my head I don't want this to work. And then someone goes, oh, but if you like him, you can take him to Australia. I'm like, I can't get myself in. You know, if I can't get myself in, you're fucked. It could be another year before I even hear back from my decision on PR, which might not even be a yes. It takes me to 33. So there are so many British people and Irish people in Australia that aren't sure where they live. They go to bed in Australia, but they have limited amounts of time before they might have to come back. And if you're the type of person like me that goes there and you go, this is where I want to be home, nothing else really cuts it. People go, oh, you might like America. You're like, well, I don't want to live in America. oh, I'm sure you'll love it. The beaches are amazing in LA. You're like, yeah, but I don't live in LA. Oh, you should just go to Europe. You're like, what? And have no friends and somewhere nice in Europe. Like, so this whole kind of limbo at the moment, I'm not giving myself permission to be happy in the UK because it's not where I want to be.
You do know that that is a very good coping mechanism though. That's a very, very good get out of jail free card that allows you to continue your avoidant behavior.
Oh yeah. It's a classic trait of the avoidant. But for me,
because
as well,
it's justified by something which genuinely exists. Like this is it's a compelling narrative. It genuinely is. But on top of that, it's a very convenient narrative for you, given your particular attachment style.
Oh yeah, yeah, I'm aware of that. But I'd rather be wrong in Australia than right in the UK. So like, yeah, and to be fair, like, you're always in this constant battle where like I was hungover the other day. I go see my parents. I was like, this is nice. But there's, and do you know what? I'd love to be wrong. I'd love to go to Oz, move there for 3-4 years and go, I had it wrong. I'd love to be wrong and want to come home. But for the time being, for, as far as quality of life, there's just like, I never appreciated how much I love blue skies. It sounds like such a weird thing. I'm sat here now, I'm looking at a gray sky. It's August. It's in the UK. It's freezing today. Absolutely fucking freezing. And I've never, do you know what? I discovered a lot about my values in Australia. And how much I love wholesome activities.
Give me some of your favorite wholesome activities.
So like I would nap in the afternoon, which I do here, but then I'd have a cup of instant coffee, a bowl of cereal, and wait for my housemate Cam to come home. We'd go swim in the sea and go down. And I'm my happiest. It's cold in the sea. It's
dog
freezing.
Wagging its tail. Yeah.
Yeah. Go jump in, piss about, like jumping through the waves, getting beaten up, come home. Like in the morning, hey lads, 6 a.m., sunrise dips. No one can deny a sunrise dip. The only thing getting in the way of a sunrise dip is you not wanting to get out of bed. So then we'll just fucking pull you out of bed. And like, I lived in a budget house in Australia. My rent's like £200 a week. I lived in a bit of a shithole part of Sydney, but I was happy. Whereas in London, I need to live somewhere nice. I'm living in Richmond, living on my own, living in a posh area because I need to get my happiness from that because I'm not getting it from outside the house.
You have to compensate. Yeah.
Yeah. Richmond Park's lovely, but I don't want to be there. After I'm in there for an hour going for a jog, I'm like, oh, I'm bored of this now. Get me home. I watch so much more TV here. And like, although there's just so many kind of wholesome parts to me that are unfulfilled here. Like I haven't swum in the sea now for like 2 months.
So here's something that I think a lot of entrepreneurs need to realize about being in the UK. If you are in the UK, if you're somewhere else that you just don't like where you live, one way to look at that is I am not being fulfilled externally in some of the ways that living somewhere better, quote unquote, would facilitate me. But on the flip side, it's a forcing function that permits you to spend more time on work. Like if you need to front load the amount of effort that you put into a business or growth or your skill development or whatever it is, living somewhere shit is actually a really good forcing function for that because there are fewer things to distract you. Now, the argument would be, what is the end goal reason of you being good at the business? It's to have a life which makes me feel happy. So why not just shortcut it and live somewhere good in the first place? But there is also, I think that you would agree too, there is like there's an entry requirement, right? There's like a buy-in that you need to get. Like you need to get to a minimum level of income and security with the business. And if you can front load the work that gets you to that more soon, this is one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you about. I know you are a little averse to buying property, that buying property is something that you're not a huge believer in. And I was really interested to dig into that. What's your reasons for that?
So first of all, a lot of people can't really afford to buy houses. They can't. Majority of people can't afford to buy houses. The majority of people in their 20s should be figuring out who they are and what they want to do. But instead they get sidetracked. So they get into a job that pays 20K, then it pays 25. And it pays 30. And they're now working a job they don't really like for 30K. They then start eyeballing a house. They end up then buying a property somewhere they don't want to live. It's someone they probably don't want to spend the rest of their life with so they can get a mortgage to appease their parents. They then remain working a job they don't like to live in a house in a place they don't want to live to afford a mortgage with a partner that they don't want to be with. And suddenly they're not only trapped by the partner, they're now trapped by their job. They can't just leave their job and go start a career. Can't go turn a hobby into a passion. They now have the pressure of, if I break up with my partner, I'm going to have to take on the mortgage payments myself that I can't afford because I'm not earning enough money to do so. So I think a lot of people are living in this existential fuck up, where even if they do break up with their partner, they now need to sell the house. And any money they did make on the house has now got to go stamp duty, fees, fucking legal, all of this shit, right? I think a lot of people fall into that trap. Not everyone. But when I'm giving advice to people, it's to those people. You know, living an hour away from your fucking job. I've got friends now at the moment. I think they're fucking crazy. They're 32 and they're living with the parents of one of the couple an hour and a quarter outside of London to save money for a house. I was like, you guys are in the prime of your fucking life and you are living in the middle of fucking nowhere to save money. Why not just buy a house in a few years' time when you can afford it? Why not just live near your fucking office, enjoy your life, you'll get promoted in a few years' time, you'll be all right. It breaks me that people are prioritizing the agreement on a bit of paper over their life. Because at the end of the day, buying a property is just changing the belief system in who that property belongs to. If I buy the property I'm in right now, nothing really changes. I still sit here. I still pay money out each week. I still sleep on that sofa. I go upstairs into a bed. But for me to buy this, I need to give up £1.5 million or step into debt for the rest of fucking my mad old life until I pay it off. For me, if I had £1.5 million, I'd go, yeah, I'll just buy this. Cool. I'll just buy it. It'd be worth a bit more in a bit of time. And when I go to Australia, I probably will buy something because I've got money that I'm not using. That makes sense. But for people to, you know, in your 20s, my mum and dad never ever said to me to get a mortgage. This is why I stand like this. Like, go enjoy yourself. They said, actually, you know, my mum and dad still haven't paid off their mortgage, but they said, when we die, we'll leave some money. You can put it down and buy a house. Don't worry about it. Enjoy your 20s. I enjoyed my fucking 20s. I played rugby in New Zealand. I went to Thailand on 2 weeks' notice. I went to Australia at 27. I lived the best life ever, and living my best life put me in a position to follow my passion. And now, because of that, I'll probably buy a house outright. And it won't sting when I buy it. I won't need a partner forced into that position to help me buy it either. People go, renting is a waste. Renting is not waste. Renting is freedom. Renting is deciding you want to fucking move next week. Fine. Renting is not worrying about mortgage payments. Renting is not staying with a partner that you don't want to be with just to fucking cover the costs. You pay the price whichever way you go. And for me, I love the idea that I might go, I'm going to America tomorrow. The border's open. I don't want to worry about having to fill it. Tenants calling me at 4 a.m. when I'm in America. James, the boiler's gone. Oh, fucking hell, let me get someone out. There are different people out there that want different things. If you want to buy a house, you're just going to ignore what I'm saying. But for a lot of people, there are way better things to be doing in your 20s than saving for a house. And if you do what you want in your 20s, you might just have the money to buy one outright in your 30s or even your 40s.
There's a stat in the happiness hypothesis by Jonathan Haidt that says the single biggest determinant of happiness, or the single tightest correlation that he could find, was the commute to work. So the longer that your commute to work, the lower your life happiness. That was the tightest correlation that he was able to find throughout his entire research in a book on happiness. So I think that you are right when people buy houses for the wrong reasons. I would posit that for people at the lower end of the income bracket and people at the absolute top end of the income bracket, renting for both of those people makes sense. But for people who are in the middle, they're going to be able to make maybe £10,000 plus per year over the top of what they need to live so that they would be able to save that. For me, there's no better place for you to put your money because you're going to turn cash into an asset that is going to generate money over time. So the house that I'm in right now, I have two other housemates that live in this with me, and they pay the mortgage, the electricity, the water, the rates, the tax, the cleaner, the internet. And you go, okay, so now I live rent-free. So I live rent-free plus all of the money that was going into rent goes into bricks and mortar, and that's equity that's owned by me. And all I've done is rinsed and repeated that. So I've just bought house number 5, which is completing this week. And it's just buy to let. Find 35 grand-ish, put it into a 3-bed house. That generates about 800 and something pounds a month. And you go again, and you go again, and you go again. And over time, that compounds. So I understand that for somebody that really wants freedom and doesn't have the cash that sits over the top of that in order to give them the extra leeway that they need, that would be a bad piece of advice. If you have tons and tons of money, then fuck it. It doesn't matter because you don't need the extra income afforded by letting properties or by assisting yourself to reduce your living costs. But for somebody that sits in that middle bracket, I actually think that it's a really smart potential. Now, this being said, you need to do it in a city where you're able to buy properties where the yield is sufficiently okay. London is not this place. The amount of money that you need to put down on a property versus the amount of money it's going to earn you back in terms of your rent is essentially pointless. Like, you might even lose money on that property. But outside of that, somewhere like Newcastle, somewhere up north, I think it's a good potential.
So I completely agree with what you're saying there, and what you're doing is incredibly smart. But then the second caveat point comes in, that doesn't interest me. And that's not to say what you're doing is bad. It's to say that doesn't interest me. So that people go, well, you're a fool because you could be making this, this, and this. And for me, when we could sit in armchairs when we're 65 and you could sit back with more money than me and go, I've got 45 houses. And I could sit back and go, I could have had 45 houses, but I didn't do anything that never interested me. And I would be proudly sat back on that little armchair going, I had plenty of opportunities to invest my money and do smart things with it, but it didn't interest me. And I could be wrong. I could change in 5 years. But ultimately, I love doing talks, meets, writing books. I would rather say you go, James, bought this house for 35 grand and then a mortgage, whatever. I'd say, I'm going to the Maldives. How long does 35 grand get me? I'll get you 12 weeks, sir. Cool. All right, I'm going to take 10 hardbacks with me. And I'm going to write a new book and I'm going to get the advance from that. And you know what I mean? And for me, financially, that is a worse decision. But over the next year of my life or going away and doing random shit like that, I could be wrong with this gamble. I could be so wrong, but I can't wait to just invest in myself. And one day when I have a family home, I will buy it so that when I die, someone has it. And again, this disagree with me on this, right? My mom and dad created a comfortable life for me, but they never gave me money. Because they never gave me money, I was in the job center when I was 19, knocking on doors for a living. I worked in a pub on a caravan site when I was 16. That was excellent. When I look at people that are given too much by their parents, they don't have the work ethic they should. So like, again, I have this kind of mentality in my mind of just wanting to spend it all. I joke around with my business partner saying inheritance tax should be 100%. The state
forces you to finish it by the end of your life.
Yeah, spend it, do it, live a life, get rid of all of it. And then your kids don't get anything at the end of it. So you have to bring up your kids with that.
I think that the same mentality for me, coming from a working class background, not really having money, you know, being like literally skint, bones of my ass, couldn't drive myself home from my placement year at uni back to uni when the placement year went kaput. But I didn't have the money to put the petrol in my car to get home. And that was 20 years old. And then 13 years later, you know, being able to afford 5 houses and have varieties of income and stuff like that. But I think that the coming from that background of no money has actually lent me to have like ambient monetary anxiety. So for me, I require a greater sense of comfort. I need to know what is coming in each month. And the position at which I feel, right, fine, I'm now liberated to fuck off to the Maldives and drop 35 grand. Like, it's only getting toward the place now where that's something that I would feel comfortable doing, because the prudence and the conservatism financially that has kind of been quite pervasive, especially if you've come from never having money. I do think that we've got sort of two different role models going on here. One of them is never came from money, it's fine. Even if I don't have any, it doesn't matter. And the other one is never came from money, fuck, I've now got some, hold on to it at all costs and make it earn more for me.
And they're both correct, because they're both are in line with our values and what we find happy. Do you know what, man? Sometimes I wish I could love Newcastle, someone like that. Do you know how lucky you are to be in a part of the world like that and to love it? You love it, right?
It's good. It's good, man. It is. It's a small city that's easy to win at, and that was something that I really, really enjoyed. I wouldn't say that it's the best place to live in the UK. I've been to, you know, I do enjoy London. I enjoy being in cosmopolitan cities and stuff like that. But it is fun.
It's good nightlife. You get flights in and out of it. You know, why I like. I almost wish I never became such a fucking snob for the good location, life.
Yeah.
Because like, I remember Sonny Webster, a good friend of mine, pretty sure you know him, like the Olympian lifter. He calls me up one day, he goes, oh, I'm having a bad day. I'm like, come around, we're going for a walk. And we'd walk and I could see the sea and there's blue skies and there's sun and everything like that. I can't go back from that. I can't step backwards from that life. And like, I probably will be hypocritical when I will be a hypocrite when I do buy in Australia. But then I think it's slightly different values. When I go, you've been to us?
No.
There's an area called Gold Coast, and it's on the beach, and you get a lot for your money there. And I actually want to keep living in Sydney, but I actually want to buy a big 4-bedroom house in Gold Coast on the water, not too far from a beach, because then I want to have an open invite for all of my friends to come to Australia and to stay in that house. So even if I'm living in Sydney, I'm like, right, guys, this weekend, come. Here's the key code for the front door. Come stay with me. And if my friends got families, they got kids, they got whatever, they all stay in that house. Even if I'm in the UK, hey, go stay in my house over there. I'd love to create that like community environment where there's like a cinema room and something for this and that, a barbecue outside. And for me, the idea of buying that is amazing, because then I get to part my money and other people get to use it, and they don't get to feel like they're getting a handout. I'm like, yo, come stay with me. But that excites me. But outside of that, my freedom is so important to me. And like, I'm not saying that you've jeopardized any of yours. And I always think in the back of my mind as well, did you ever think that like when the pandemic started, I was like, if we lose 25% of the population, property prices are going to fucking, that cryptocurrency is going down, right? If we get another SARS-CoV-3, just saying, it comes out with a high fatality rate. I mean, what was the plague? It's like 25 million or something stupid. No, maybe not 25 million, maybe 25 million. Maybe someone come out like that, Chris, mate. Them houses, right? Tenants gone, everyone else gone. More houses than we know what to do with. It's going to be like the problem in China, having too many men for the amount of women. Just saying, mate, you know, it bricks and mortar, they say it only goes one way until it doesn't.
Well, it's only gone one way throughout all of history. And whatever it is, past performance is not an indication of future returns. Absolutely right. That being said, man, fucking the people that trade cryptocurrency and stuff like that, they have balls of steel. That's something that I absolutely could not do. Yeah, I mean, the last year, house prices in the UK have risen by the highest percentage ever.
That's what they want you to believe.
I've just paid for one. I know that it's gone up by a lot. We've got IFS coming up this weekend. What are you doing there?
Weekend after next. Don't scare me.
No. When this releases. It is this weekend in podcast world.
Okay, yeah, sorry. I've only just started doing that. Whenever I do a podcast, I'm like, let's release it. They're like, don't fucking release it. IFS this weekend. In essence, I went to a fitness expo, Body Power, no names, whoops, a few years ago.
Sorry, Nick Orton.
I was like, fuck, this has potential to be so amazing. Like, we go to one area, there were like evidence-based speakers in the smallest little tent. And then you got, you know, just supplement stand, topless bodybuilders. And I was like, this is fucking disgusting. And I remember joking around with my events team and saying something like, look, there's so much scope for this to be better. And they were like, well, let's do it. So I sat down with the organizers. I was like, look, these are the kind of people we need to have to attend it. And then they're like, okay, what about a party? I'm like, yes, have a big party. So 2019, went Barcelona, Charlie Sloth on the DJ set. Like, it was lit. It was amazing. But the core component of it is business to business for personal trainers, because there is not enough support or education for PTs to run a good business. You could be the best PT in the world, but if you're not charging good money and growing your business, you will die out. Because even if you're a really enthusiastic 24-year-old charging £50 an hour, if you do not learn how to master commoditization and demand or build money online, you're going to have a family soon, and your family are only going to be home in the most in-demand hours as a PT. And if you do not learn how to work around that, you're pretty much fucked. And to be able to host an event where you get to upskill personal trainers and teach them how to run a business with the best minds in the world, and most people go, I haven't heard of the other five people. And I go, yeah, they're the ones I fucking learned it from. So, you know, you got that. And then this B2C element on the outside where people can come along. Me and you, you're going to be at the bar having a gin and tonic. Someone comes over. Hey, guys, love your podcast. You'd be like, which one? And then, you know.
Classic.
And like going around having like drinks with people. I think Budgie Smuggler were like trying to do a Ninja Warrior course. Grenada bringing a hot air balloon. Like, there's panels inside where people can talk. There's a mental health panel. There's a panel on whether or not the fitness industry is sexist. Like, we got all these like juicy things. And it's not expensive to come down for the weekend. A lot of people haven't had a proper festival vibe in quite a while. And yeah, it's just exciting. And my events team have done fucking an amazing job. They've got a background of like music festivals and events. So the production is lit. You go to some places and they've got like a DJ set on fucking shit production and shit speakers. So yeah, Mr. Jam's playing in the evening. And I don't know if you've seen Mr. Jam live.
Yeah, we've booked him a couple of times. He kills it.
He is unreal. The energy that guy brings.
Insane. Yeah.
Insane. So like, I'm buzzing. I'll be pulling out the yellow tint glasses, up and about on the dance floors. No selfies after 10 p.m.
Yeah, man, I'm gassed for it. I'm gassed. I'm hosting the podcast panel 3 p.m. on the Saturday on whatever the fuck stage that is. So if anyone is listening, I was supposed to have a link. I was supposed to get some sort of a link. If they just Google International Fitness Summit.
Yeah, .com.
It'll come up and get your tickets this Saturday and Sunday. And then is there a thing on the Friday? Are you guys doing a meetup on the Friday?
No, on the Saturday, the first hour on Saturday is a meetup for solo travelers. So we're going to get name tags for all people that are traveling on their own. I'm trying to get colored name tags so you can get green, amber, red. I don't want to traffic light it.
Dating one. Right. Okay. Yeah.
Single taken or not sure. So
not sure. Anyone that wears the amber one, it's so funny. It's like, what are you doing?
Playing hard to get.
What are you here for? Apparently, avoidant behavior.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently club nights at the moment, that's a big no-no, the traffic light systems.
Well, we do it only on Valentine's Day. We do it every year on Valentine's Day at our events.
So there's some controversy about that. People saying that, oh, you can't do that anymore. It's fucking degrading or something like that.
Not in Newcastle, man. Newcastle doesn't fold to this woke stuff. Like, it's just such salt of the earth people. When you have lads that wear rigger boots and use the plaster dust from the work that they've done during the day to chalk up the bar before they lift in the gym on an evening time, and they've still got like their work overalls on and a high-vis t-shirt, like they're not bothered about gender neutral bathrooms and whether or not parties are racist.
I need to get out of London.
I know.
I went for a coffee earlier and it's like, this toilet is gender neutral, and I was like, fucking hell, just be like, just have a sign saying use whatever one you want, or just toilet, you know, if they just If you want to cater for all genders, all 72 of them, and you've got two toilets in a building that you don't mind people using, just take the M and the F sticker off, right, and just have toilet. Like, the overreaching of the woke stuff, fuck me, Newcastle's never sounded so appealing.
I know, man. I know, it really does help. But yeah, so internationalfitnesssummit.com, if people want to go and get the tickets. Saturday is the more, Sunday's the more sort of PT side one, right? It's the more businessy side one.
Saturday's for everyone. Party vibes, go around, you know, panels, gin tonics, big party in the evening, probably active wear by day, and then party gear by night. Then we're all going to meet up about 9:30 on Sunday, hungover. We've got over 500 personal trainers doing the B2B on the Sunday, where Darren, myself, Phil Graham, Paul Moore, Mark Coles, Jay Alderton are doing these business to business talks. They're going to be like TED talks about things that probably people are getting wrong, things you can work around it, interactive Q&A. Then by Sunday night, we can all die and maybe end up going for a beer.
I love it, man. I'm sick. I can't wait to go. I'm coming down on the Saturday morning, I think. So I'm going to be like caffeinated on the train and pushing myself straight onto the stage. It's going to be fun.
Sick. I'm buzzing for it.
I'm gassed. James Smith, ladies and gentlemen, people want to check out your stuff. Where should they go?
Just type in James Smith. It was tough at first, right? When I started, I'd had to say...
Very normie name, isn't it? There's a lot of them.
Yeah, but I'm now top of the algorithm.
Number
tonight.
One James Smith in the world. Imagine that. Well, imagine being the number one James Smith in the world.
There's a singer who won't be too happy about that. But
there's a very anti-Semitic Labour MP called Chris Williamson from Derby, who I'm desperately trying to beat in Google rankings. I've got him on pretty much everything except for just like the top three on Google soon.
Well, they give us a year, lad. Give us a year and we'll be top of that. But yeah, type in James Smith, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, everywhere. I'm everywhere.
Peace, man. See you on Saturday.
Thank you, mate.